Hello, and welcome to As It Is, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's July 24th, 2016. Here's what's ahead on today's program. In our weekly Higher Education Report, correspondent Pete Musto reports on freedom of speech and political correctness on college campuses in the United States. Then, Anna Mateo will be with us, as she is every Sunday, with Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. And as we always do on the Sunday edition of As It Is, we will present The Making of a Nation. Now, correspondent Pete Musto tells us about clashes between freedom of speech and political correctness at some American colleges.
Freedom of speech is protected in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But universities across the U.S. are debating if they will tolerate all kinds of speech on campus, even speech that students say is offensive, hateful, or divisive. For example, in 2015, a University of Kansas professor almost lost her job after students complained that she used the racial slur known as the N-word. The word has historically been used in the U.S. to demean African Americans. However, a four-month investigation showed the professor used the word not as an insult, but as part of a discussion on race. At Yale University, two professors, a husband and wife, both stepped down from their positions in May 2016. This came after students demanded they be removed for an email one of the professors sent to students. The email criticized the university administration for asking students to avoid wearing costumes that might be considered culturally insensitive for the holiday called Halloween. And in Illinois last year, Northwestern University investigated one of its professors after she wrote a controversial article for the Chronicle of Higher Education. In it, the professor criticized some universities' new rules against sexual relationships between professors and students. She said the rules promoted an idea of professors as having nearly unlimited power over students. And, she said, the rules promoted an idea of students as victims. Those ideas, she said, create a feeling of extreme fear about sex. Students reacted strongly to the article. They said the professor's words made them feel uncomfortable about reporting sexual misbehavior on campus. Eventually, the university announced the professor had not violated any law. In answer to these events and others, university leaders are discussing how free speech fits into higher education. Scott A. Bass is the provost at American University, or AU, in Washington, D.C. He has worked in higher education for almost 40 years. Bass says professors have a duty to challenge their students' thinking. He says professors should discuss topics that may be controversial or make students feel uncomfortable.
That is part of the college experience, to read, to think, to hear ideas that may be congruent or different than what you have long thought. That is part of the development of intellectual life and part of what a university stands for.
Bass says the faculty senate at AU shares this view of a college experience. In 2015, the Senate voted to approve a statement protecting freedom of speech at their school. Bass says the faculty senate at AU rarely completely agrees on anything. But every single member agreed to the statement released last September. The statement said, in part, "As laws and individual sensitivities may seek to restrict, label, warn, or exclude specific content, the university must stand firm as a place that is open to diverse ideas and free expression. These are standards that American University will not compromise." AU is not the only university to make such a statement. In the last 2 years, faculty committees at the University of Chicago and the University of Minnesota formally defended freedom of speech at their schools. Colin Campbell is the head of that faculty committee at the University of Minnesota. He says the faculty chose to approve the statement following several student protests about controversial events outside the classroom. In one event, students objected to a poster that showed an image of the Muslim religious figure Muhammad. The image was originally published by the French magazine Charlie Hebdo after a 2015 attack on its offices in Paris. Faculty created the poster to advertise an event discussing, ironically, free speech. But University of Minnesota students complained that the poster was offensive to Muslim people. Most Muslims around the world object to drawings or other visual images of Muhammad. In another event at the University of Minnesota, some students protested when other students invited a divisive journalist to speak on campus. Journalist Milo Yiannopoulos is well known for making controversial statements. Stephanie Taylor helped organize the protest. She belongs to a group called Students for a Democratic Society at the University of Minnesota, or SDS. The group objects to Yiannopoulos, calling his language and ideas hate speech. Taylor says the protests were not trying to prevent Yiannopoulos from speaking or anyone else from listening. But, she says, her group believes they must speak against people they feel use their public identities only to spread hate.
These are speakers that have free speech all the time, and they actually have more platforms than most people do on this campus. That is, the positions of power that they're in, the money that they're being given to spew, for lack of a better word, ideas at people that are not, in our opinion, furthering a greater good.
Campbell says students often protest when controversial public figures come to campus. He agrees that universities hold power when it comes to who teaches and whom they invite to speak. Yet, Campbell says shouting and making noise does not help people with different beliefs reach common ground.
Your ability to understand your own arguments becomes stronger when they're challenged. And I feel like our culture would be strengthened by examining and debating and discussing with individuals with whom we don't agree.
Campbell adds that free speech at universities has brought positive social change. He says that 30 years ago, most people did not want to discuss HIV/AIDS because it was a disease that mostly affected the homosexual community. But because universities were able to explore a controversial topic, researchers could achieve many successes towards treating the disease. Bass at American University says young people today have problems accepting opinions different from their own. Social media makes it possible for young people to read and hear only information they already agree with, he says. Indeed, public opinion in the U.S. seems to be moving toward limiting free speech. A 2015 Pew Research Center study showed that 40% of Americans between 18 and 35 years old believe the government should be able to censor language that is offensive to minorities. But Bass says it is important to remember that censorship has a dark history. In the U.S. in the 1940s and 1950s, government officials used censorship to prevent people from supporting communism. At the time, Senator Joseph McCarthy became known for investigating so-called critics of the government. His campaign unfairly ruined the careers and reputations of many people. Sarah McBride offers another point of view. She asks universities simply to proceed carefully with heated subjects. McBride is the National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign, or HRC. The HRC is a nonprofit group that supports equal treatment for homosexual and transgender people. McBride says students from marginalized populations have often lived through horrible experiences. Sometimes discussing these topics can cause people to relive these experiences. Many young people have asked professors at least to warn students that difficult topics will be discussed. However, Bass at AU says professors cannot possibly know of every bad experience that every student has ever had. Universities should try to create support and community for these students, he says. But creating that kind of warning system, called trigger warnings by some, would be almost impossible. McBride acknowledges that students and faculty must work together to find solutions.
Schools individually should and can make the decision about what is hate speech and what is offensive. But it's not this black and white conversation that I think folks on both sides tend to make it out as.
Campbell at the University of Minnesota agrees with McBride. Neither side of this debate is completely right, they say. For one thing, Campbell says, his students' objections to some speech suggest they are much more understanding of other people and cultures than students were in his generation. And, he says, that attitude makes him proud. But in the end, Campbell adds, universities can only create policies which suggest what sort of language and activity they feel is inappropriate. It is the role of the U.S. Supreme Court to decide what is legally protected under freedom of speech. I'm Pete Musto.
Now, it's time for Onomateo and Words and Their Stories. This week, Anna brings us the second part of her two-part report on the word apple.
Apples are good for us, and someone who does good things can be described as a good apple. But there are also bad apples. And we all know that one bad apple spoils the bunch. Let's say there is a classroom of very well-behaved children. All the students are respectful. They do not shout or speak out of turn while the teacher is talking. Then a new student arrives. This student talks loudly and shows disrespect to the teacher. Soon other students follow her lead and disrupt class. In this example, you could say that one bad apple spoiled the whole bunch. Now, students who misbehave in class are not necessarily bad people. But if the student we just talked about also steals apples from the store and then throws them at very old women, you could say she is rotten to the core. Even a bad child can be loved by their parents. The father of this girl might say, "My daughter would never do such things. She is the apple of my eye." But this student is not the apple of the teacher's eye. The teacher punishes her, and the class returns to the way it was. The other parents are very happy about this. They might even say, How about them apples? Or how do you like them apples? This expression is the same as saying, well, what do you think about that? It can also be a way of showing you like or admire something. I know, the grammar in the expression, how about them apples, is not exactly right, but that is how we say it. Americans even shorten the word about to simply bout. You won't hear anyone say, how about those apples? The grammar is the main reason this expression sounds warm, folksy, and rural to the ear. Well, the grammar and the apples. And remember, it sounds like a country or rural expression. If a good friend tells you that their original cake recipe just won first place at a baking competition, how about them apples would be a great response to that news. However, if a friend from New York City tells you that they just won a high-profile writing award, you might want to say something else. But comparing language used in a small farming town with the language used in a city like New York is like comparing apples and oranges. There is no point because they are both so different. I'm Ana Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation. The election of Herbert Hoover as president in 1928 made Americans more hopeful than ever about their future. Hoover seemed to have just the right experience to lead the nation to greater economic success. He was an engineer and a businessman who had served as Secretary of Commerce. He understood economics and had faith in the future of private business. On a rainy day in March 1929, Hoover rode down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington to be inaugurated as the new president. "I have no fears for the future of our country," he told the cheering crowd. "It is bright with hope." This week in our series, Faith Lapidus and Bob Doty tell us more about the Republican administration of Herbert Hoover.
The clearest evidence of the public's faith in the economy is the stock market. And the New York Stock Exchange reacted to the new president with a wild increase in prices. During the months after Hoover's election, prices generally rose like a rocket. Stocks valued at $100 climbed to $200, then $300, $400. Men and women made huge amounts of money overnight. Publications and economic experts advised Americans to buy stocks before prices went even higher. Time and again, people heard how rich they could become if they found and bought stocks for companies growing into industrial giants. "Never sell the United States short," said one publication. Another just said, "Everybody ought to be rich."
A number of economic experts worried about the sharp increase in stock prices that followed Hoover's election. The president himself urged stock market officials to make trading more honest and safe. And he approved a move by the Federal Reserve Board to increase the interest charged to banks. However, both efforts failed to stop the growing number of Americans who were spending their money wildly on stocks. Some experts pointed to danger signs in the economy during the summer of 1929. The number of houses being built was dropping. Industries were reducing the amount of products that they held in their factories. The rate of growth in spending by average Americans was falling sharply. And industrial production, employment, and prices were down. These experts warned that the American economy was just not strong enough to support such rapid growth in stock prices. They said there was no real value behind many of the high prices. They said a stock price could not increase 4 times while a company's sales stayed the same. They said the high prices were built on foolish dreams of wealth, not real value.
But the prices went still higher. Buyers fought with each other to pay more and more for company stocks. The average price of all stocks almost doubled in just 1 year. It seemed everybody was buying stocks, even people with little money or economic training. A clothing salesman got advice from a stock trader visiting his store and made $200,000. A nurse learned of a good company from someone in the hospital. She made $30,000. There were thousands of such stories. By early September, the stock market reached its high point of the past 18 months. Shares of the Westinghouse Company had climbed from $91 to $313. The Anaconda Copper Company had risen from $54 to $162. Union Carbide jumped from $145 to $413. Life was like a dream, but like any dream, it could not last forever.
In September 1929, stock prices stopped rising. During the next month and a half, stock prices fell, but only slowly. Then, suddenly, at the end of October, the market crashed. Prices dropped wildly. Leading stocks fell $5, $10, $20 in a single day. Everyone tried to sell their stocks, but no one was buying. Fear washed across the stock market. People were losing money even faster than they had made it.
The stock market collapsed on Thursday, October 24th, 1929. People remember the day as Black Thursday, the day the dreams ended. The day began with a wave of selling. People from across the country sent messages to their stock traders in New York. All the messages said the same thing. Sell! Sell the stocks at any price possible! No one was buying, and so down the prices came. The value of stock for the Montgomery Ward store dropped from $83 to $50 in a single day. The RCA Radio Corporation fell from $68 to $44, down $24 in just a few hours. Down the stocks fell, lower and lower. Several of the country's leading bankers met to discuss ways to stop the disaster. They agreed to buy stocks in large amounts to stop the wave of selling. The bankers moved quickly, and for 2 days, prices held steady. But then, Like snow falling down the side of a mountain, the stocks dropped again. Prices went to amazingly low levels. One business newspaper said simply, "The present week has witnessed the greatest stock market disaster of all time."
The stock market crash ruined thousands of Americans. In a few short weeks, traders lost $30 billion, an amount almost as great as all the money the United States had spent in World War I. Some businessmen could not accept what had happened. They jumped from the tops of buildings and killed themselves. In fact, one popular joke of the time said that hotel owners had to ask people if they wanted rooms for sleeping or jumping. But the stock market crash was nothing to laugh about. It destroyed much of the money that Americans had saved. Even worse, it caused millions of people to worry and lose faith in the economy. They were not sure what to expect tomorrow. Business owners would not spend money for new factories or business operations. Instead, they decided to wait and see what would happen. This reduced production and caused more workers to lose their jobs. Fewer workers meant fewer people with money to buy goods. And fewer people buying goods meant less need for factories to produce. So it went. In short, economic disaster.
Why did the stock market crash? One reason, people had been paying too much for stocks. Everyone believed that prices would go higher and higher forever. People paid more for stocks than the stocks were worth. They hoped to sell the stocks at even higher prices. It was like a children's balloon that expands with air, blowing bigger and bigger until it bursts. But there were other important reasons. Industrial profits were too high and wages too low. 5% of the population owned 1/3 of all personal income. The average worker simply did not have enough money to buy enough of all the new goods that factories were producing. Another problem was that companies were not investing enough money in new factories and supplies. There were also problems with the rules of the stock market itself. People were allowed to buy stocks when they did not have the money to do so.
Several government economic policies also helped cause the stock market crash of 1929. Government tax policies made the rich richer and the poor poorer. And the government did little to control the national money supply, even when the economy faced disaster. The stock market crash marked the beginning of the Great Depression, a long, slow, painful fall to the worst economic crisis in American history. The Depression would bring suffering to millions of people. It would cause major political changes, and it would be a major force in creating the conditions that led to World War II. We will look at the beginning of the Great Depression next week on The Making of a Nation on As It Is, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. Jonathan Evans will be here tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with As It Is Monday from The Voice of America.